The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2019 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2019. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
Well, thank you very much, and it's a blessing to be with you all this afternoon. It's interesting, we have our offices down the street here in Atlanta, in Alpharetta, and I have a little bit of a space issue here. There we go. All right. I find myself in Alpharetta or in Atlanta very often to do office and business meetings at our offices there, but this is, I think, the second time in my career where I've come to Atlanta specifically not to go to our office but to speak somewhere. So it's quite refreshing. It's also closer to the airport, which makes the commute quite a bit better. If you've ever been through Atlanta traffic, and it probably, my guess is that some of you have, you know that being closer to the airport is good, and being further from the airport is just terrible. Really is a blessing here. My name is Abdu Murray. I'm thrilled to be with you all. I'm going to be speaking on a bit of a headier or a tougher topic, I think, today. That is a cultural assessment, but how the gospel and the credibility of the gospel can actually speak to a very, I think, weary culture, a culture that's weary of its own sort of indulgences within itself. And I want to share that with you today. And the book that this talk is based on, Saving Truth, is actually available. My understanding, it's available in the exhibit room. Our RZIM has a table there. You'll find books by me, and then Ravi and other members of our team are also available at our book area there, and my two colleagues, Jennifer and Ingrid, would love to meet you and say hi. As I begin to speak about this idea of finding clarity in a culture of confusion, I'm reminded of something that happened to me not too long ago. I was traveling, I travel a lot internationally. I traveled, I think, last year about 180-something days, both in the United States, Canada, and abroad speaking, and when I speak internationally, usually I fly. But I live in Michigan. I don't actually live here in the Atlanta area, though our offices are based here. We have an office in Detroit. And because of the geography of Michigan and Canada, there's this peninsula that comes down where Leamington and Windsor and all these places are in Canada, which makes Canada, strangely enough, the country directly to my south, actually, instead of directly to my north. So sometimes when I drive to Canada, I drive south to go speak into the Toronto area or other parts of Ontario. Well, in this particular day, I was speaking, it was a beautiful summer day, I was speaking at an open-air evangelism event in a place called Wallaceburg. And Wallaceburg does not go south. I had to go a little bit north to a town called Algonac and cross over the river to get to Canada by a car ferry. Now, I'm from the Great Lakes State. The largest freshwater lakes in the world surround my state. So when I think car ferry, I think of a ship that could hold 30 or 40 cars. That was not this car ferry. This car ferry was this tiny little rickety boat that held two cars maximum. The paint was peeling off of it. It was like the kind of thing where I was gonna drive my car on it and I half expected the guy to pull me across the river like Lord of the Rings style, you know, with a rope or something. So I get onto this car ferry, and I'm also terrible with directions. I can get lost in my own backyard, so I'm constantly looking at my GPS, which has atrophied my ability to know north, south, east, and west. But I'm looking at my GPS all the time to make sure I'm going to the right place. So I'm driving to this particular international speaking event, and I'm obsessed with looking at my GPS, so I pull onto the car ferry. He says, "You're the only passenger I have. Just stay in your car, and it'll be a short ride, and we'll get there quick." Said, great, so I'm looking at my GPS. It was the exact moment when I looked at my GPS to make sure I was going to the right place that the boat left the dock. So I didn't see us leave the dock, I was looking down. Because of the mass of the car and the suspension in the car, it absorbed the energy of us leaving the dock, so I didn't feel us leave the dock either. So when I looked up, I had that strange vertigo you have, you know, where you sat at the intersection and there's a bus next to you and the bus begins to go forward and you're not quite sure if it's going forward or you're moving backward. And you had that moment of panic, like, I'm going to kill someone. And you hit the brakes harder instinctually. And what do you do at that moment? You look for a fixed point of reference. You look for a mailbox or a street sign or the road itself or a building, something to tell you whether you're moving relative to that which is fixed. Well, I was on a river. Everything is moving. If I'm moving, then the boat is moving. That's no point of reference. The river itself is in a constant state of flow, so that wouldn't help at all. So the nausea and the panic actually lasted a little longer than I would have liked. But when I looked at the distant shore and began to see it actually getting bigger and bigger in my field of vision, that's when my mind oriented and I knew, okay, I am in fact moving. What I feel and what I see are now matching up, and all the orientation sort of snapped into focus, and it went away. The confusion went away. I think that's a great metaphor for culture today. Today, we are in the river. There are no longer any fixed points of reference. Everything is now becoming fluid and actually motioned around us, where we're bumping into things relative to everything else. I want you to think about the questions we're asking ourselves now, things that we once thought were solidified or things that were actually foundational. They did not move. Questions like, what does it mean to be human? This is now a question. This is now up for grabs with the transhumanism movement, where we're actually talking about taking genetic therapies or other things, whether it's biotech or whatever it might be, to append onto ourselves or to edit our genes in a way, not to just combat diseases, which is a great and legitimate use of it, but to actually enhance things like, you know, getting rid of balding, which I actually am terribly in favor of, heightening eyesight, making us taller, gender selection, all these various things. We're now saying that being human isn't enough. We will be the ones who can determine what our very existence is. This is not a fake movement. This is not a sci-fi thing. This is really happening. Questions like, what does it mean to be male? What does it mean to be female? These things used to be obvious, and now they're no longer. Now they're up for grabs. We're all in the river. When you look at the various things, politically speaking, what does it mean to be on the right or on the left? Is there a extreme left? Is there an alt left? Is there an alt right? All these things are now becoming labeled and sub-labeled, so much so that we don't know where anything is anymore. And the chaos is beginning to ensue. And it's no wonder then that we're beginning to see anxiety levels in children at the highest levels they've been in a long time, possibly ever. In little children, it's no wonder they're increasing so much. I mean, think about this. They're able to tell you who and what they are at age 9, and if you don't, in some parts of the world, if you don't actually foster that, then you are guilty of child abuse. In other words, the kid can say, this is who I am, this is what I am, and you have to comply with it. And we're going to seal that decision for you. I'm a child of the 80s, and I can tell quite a few of you are a child of the 80s as well, and some of you actually have children who are children of the 80s. You just figured out who you are. And we're telling an 8-year-old or a 9-year-old, you got all the answers, and by the way, we're legally going to enforce what you say you are? No wonder their anxiety level is so high. We're giving them these decisions that they know they can't make. It reminds me of something that happened in the 80s, being a child of the 80s. Do you recall this phenomenon? They called it like Cold War neurosis or nuclear war neurosis, where children were waking up in the middle of the night screaming because they had nightmares, chronic nightmares of a Cold War that suddenly became nuclear hot because the USA and the USSR suddenly had somebody push a button and it was all over. And kids were waking up in the middle of the night screaming. Well, there was a song that was popularized in the 80s by a band called Genesis, and the song was called Land of Confusion. And if you recall some of the lyrics, they're quite apt right now. It says, oh, Superman, where are you now? When everything's gone wrong somehow, these men of steel, these men of power are losing control by the hour. That song was written 30 years ago. It could be written today. Amidst all the clamor and the desire for our preferences and our feelings to be validated in some way, for us to say who's right and who's wrong, to vilify that one and to lionize this one, amidst all of this, there's all this confusion happening, and there's these men of steel and these women of steel and these men of power and these women of power who are saying, I have the answers, I'll give you what you want, follow me, yet they're losing control by the hour. And we're looking for someone, a Superman of some kind, to bring us out of this. You see, we recognize that there is a very serious problem with the current culture where everything's up for grabs. We're in a culture of confusion where we decry clarity as a sin, but we think confusion is actually a virtue. I want you to think about this. If you're sexually confused, you're a hero. If you're morally confused, you're progressive. If you're religiously confused, like maybe all paths lead to God or they're equally valid, well, then you're tolerant. But if you're sexually not confused, if you're clear that there's a certain way sexuality ought to be expressed, that's bigoted. If you're clear on moral strictures, well, that's regressive. And if you're clear that there's good evidence that only one worldview actually leads to God, and thank God there's at least one way to God, and he's given us evidence for it, well, that is considered intolerant. So confusion has become a virtue, and clarity has become a sin. And why? Because confusion obliterates the lines. It allows us to have no borders. It allows us to have no boundaries. We can do and say and think and be whatever we want, whenever we want, in whatever way we want. And we're bumping into each other in the process, but we're sort of loving this lack of clarity. But we're clear on one thing. Here's what we're clear on. We're clear on this. Anyone who doesn't agree with me is Hitler. Now, careful what I said. I didn't say if you are neutral, you can't even be neutral anymore. You have to agree with me. You can't disagree with me and be labeled this. You have to agree with me. If you are neutral on a topic, you're still a bigot, because not to decide is to decide, apparently, in all things. You can't even have a considered opinion and say, wait a minute, let me look at the facts first. Nope, side with me, and if you don't, you're Hitler or Lenin or Stalin or pick your despot. That's what you are. And we're seeing this polarization happening. If you're on the right, only the left tells lies. If you're on the left, the right's always telling lies. If you're a centrist, the right and the left are always telling lies. We don't see each other as human beings anymore because we're in a post-truth society. What does that mean, a post-truth society? Well, just to prove the point I'm trying to make here, in 2016, at the end of, especially at the election cycle in 2016, the Oxford English Dictionary is named its Word of the Year. Now, every year it names a word of the year, and the word of the year is a word that captures the ethos and the pathos and the imagination of Western society for that particular time. And in 2016, the word of the year was post-truth. And if something is post-truth, you are post-truth if you elevate feelings and preferences above facts and truth. You're post-truth if you elevate feelings and preferences above facts and truth. Notice the careful distinction here. If you're post-truth, you don't claim that truth doesn't exist. You're not denying that truth exists like a postmodernist. You're simply saying that my preferences matter more. So postmodernism was this idea that truth as an objective concept didn't exist. Truth was all relative to our perspectives. It was part of a conversation we need to have with each other. And truth claims are really power moves. And those who have the power are trying to foist their truth claim on other people. And if we got rid of the idea of truth, we get rid of power moves. We get rid of conflict altogether. So people would say things like this. They'd say, there's no such thing as objective truth. And of course, you know, at least I hope you know, the counter response to when someone says, there's no such thing as objective truth. The response is simply to ask the question, is your statement objectively true? And if the statement is objectively true, then they're wrong. And if the statement is false, then they're also wrong. So you can actually argue with a postmodern person, which is why I think postmodernism is beginning to die its death. But from the ashes of the postmodernism heap arises this phoenix called post-truth, which is different. Postmodernism denied that truth exists. Post-truth acknowledges that truth exists, but it says, I don't care. My preferences and my feelings matter more. So when you present an argument, a well-reasoned argument full of facts and all these things to back it up, and someone says, that's great, but it happens to go against my preferences, what I feel or what I want, they will either ignore it or they will lie about it. Because preferences have won the day. It's a very scary thing. You might ask yourself the question, well then, if we can't use facts and arguments to respond to post-truth, then what can we use? I'm actually an optimist on this, despite what I'm saying right now. I'm actually an optimist on this. You see, what we've done as a culture is we have sacrificed clarity and truth on the altar of human autonomy. See, Ozguinness once put it this way, something of a paraphrase of what he said before. He says, you can judge the health of a culture by how it interacts with its chief virtues. And what is the chief virtue of Western society? It's freedom. It's on our coins, it's in our songs, it's all of our movies. Freedom, specifically the winning of freedom. We talk about it all the time, the freedom to do this, the freedom to do that, the freedom from restrictions and all these things. Well, the reality is we've stopped talking about freedom quite some time ago, and now we're talking about autonomy. We keep using the word freedom, but we don't really mean freedom. We mean autonomy. And the word autonomy comes from Greek roots, autos meaning self and nomos meaning law. So autonomy and freedom aren't synonymous, because when you are autonomous, you are a law unto yourself, which means there are no boundaries and no one else can tell you what's what, because you are a law unto yourself. And if your preferences matter, then no one can say they're illegitimate in some way. So if, here's the problem. If I'm autonomous and you're autonomous, and my preferences matter more than truth, and so do yours, when my preferences collide with your preferences, and truth is no longer the arbiter between us, it's not the thing that gauges who's right and who's wrong, when our autonomies collide and when our preferences collide, the person who wins will not be the one with truth on their side. The person who wins will be the one who has the loudest microphones or the most guns. And the real irony here is that in our quest for autonomy, the ultimate expression of freedom, we think, we end up with people who are enslaved. Because some preferences are going to matter more than others. And someone's preferences are going to be put on not only the bottom shelf, maybe excluded altogether. And we're seeing it happening around the world and even in our day today. You see, when we sacrifice clarity and truth on the altar of human autonomy, confusion will rise up from the ashes of the burnt offering. And the smoke will choke the very air out of freedom's lungs. How do you respond to this kind of situation where culture has considered confusion a virtue, clarity a sin, and preferences matter more than truth? Let me give you two ways. I think they're both important. They're dually important. It's not enough to sit here and say what's wrong with culture. You have to offer a remedy. We have to offer a remedy. So the first method, honestly, is to point out the consequences, the negative consequences of a post-truth mindset. We have to offer this, because this is an increasingly pragmatic culture. When you look at what the millennials and Gen Z are all saying about what matters to them, what matters is what works. Will it make me happy? Will it make me comfortable? Will it get me a job? Will it get me this? Will it do this? What works? Not what's true, but what works. So the pragmatism of the day can actually be used, I think, to convey the message that post-truth doesn't work. So you point out the consequences, but second, you have to offer the hope that truth actually brings. So post-truth brings negative consequences, but truth itself will bring liberation, true freedom. Let me go to the first part. One of the first consequences, I think, and there are several, that happens when we sacrifice clarity and truth on the altar of human autonomy, is that we sacrifice our God-given ability to reason, and we sacrifice all sense of human wisdom. All sense of it. Let me give you an illustration. Some years ago, I was giving my testimony about how I became a Christian. I went from Islam to Christ. And it was a men's breakfast, and it was a large room full of a lot of guys. And in the front row, there was a guy who was taking really serious notes. I mean, almost furious notes. He wasn't mad at me, but like the speed of the pen was like smoke emanating kind of thing. Wondering when the fire alarm's going to go off, because this guy's taking notes. And that's the kind of guy you know who's going to be one of the first people to come talk to you after you're done and you close your folder. Which is great. I love that kind of stuff. That's why I do what I do. So sure enough, he was. He walked up to me and he said, "I really appreciated that when you spoke about your conversion, you didn't disagree with Islam." I'm like, "I don't think you got the point." But the reason why he thought that was because when I give my testimony, when I talk about why I became a Christian, I point this out. I didn't leave Islam because it was false. I became a Christian because this is true. I embraced the light, not shunning the darkness. The darkness flees when the light's shone. So he mistook that for I wasn't disagreeing. And I said, "Buddy, let me tell you something. If I didn't disagree with it, then I would have stayed that way and saved myself and a lot of people a lot of pain. But go ahead. What do you have to say?" He said, "Well, can I show you something?" And if you're a public speaker and someone says, "Can I show you something?" it's going to be a long conversation. But it was a good one. So he had a diagram that he drew. And in the middle of the diagram was this big capital T. Like he scribbled it, bold-faced it kind of a thing. And he said, "This represents the objective total truth. And there is such a thing." I said, "Good, so far we agree." He said, but we don't know all of it. None of us know all of it. I said, well, we also agree there, because if I knew all the truth, I would be omniscient, and therefore I'd be God. So we're off to a good start. Neither you nor I are God. Excellent. But he had these little lowercase t's that were surrounding it, like a dozen of them surrounding it, and had arrows going towards it, which is a very Buddhist thing to do, by the way. And he said, he claimed to be a Christian, and he said, we all have little lowercase t versions of the truth. They're incomplete, but we all have equally valid versions of the truth. And I said, all of us? He said, yes, every human being. Like, really? Pol Pot? Mao Zedong? Idi Amin? Adolf Hitler? Stalin? Lenin? I could keep going. All these men had equally legitimate versions, though incomplete, of the truth. These are his words back to me, a very well-read, very well-meaning man. He said, I can tell you this, I don't prefer their versions of the truth, but because mine is incomplete, I can't disagree with them either. And I said, buddy, if it's one person in this world that you can disagree with and be safe, it's Hitler. It's okay to disagree with him. No one's going to get mad at you for that. And those who do get mad at you for it deserve to be angry. He says, but no, my version is incomplete, and therefore I can't stand in arrogance of disagreeing with somebody else. I said, wait, let me understand this. Are you telling me you can't disagree with anybody? He said, that's right. I said, sure you can. He said, no, I can't. I said, you just did it. There are advantages to being a trial lawyer. Now, I wasn't trying to humiliate the guy. I really wasn't. But the point is, this is a very smart man, very well-meaning. But you see what happened there? A very well-meaning, very intelligent guy who really likes people. His preference was that we all just get along and smooth over the bumps of our disagreements. But the facts were, the truth was, not all roads lead to God. In fact, not all roads even claim to lead to God. And to say they do disrespects them because you're fundamentally ignoring one of their central claims. But he was willing to do that because his preferences matter more than the truth. And I know it worked because I was walking out to the car. There he was by his car muttering to himself, if I can't disagree with anybody, but I disagreed with him. Sort of doing one of those things. But this has far more implications than just one-on-one conversations. You might recall this. I think it was 2015. It may have been 2016. I don't remember exactly. But there was a video that was circulating on YouTube where there was a protest that was happening at a university of Missouri, where the football players, amongst others, had organized a protest against some racial injustices that were happening on campus. And because it was a major Division I school and there was a protest being organized on a racial issue, the media showed up. And you want that, by the way. If you're protesting, you want the media to show up. Otherwise, it's a bunch of guys sitting on a field complaining. But they had these quote-unquote safe zones where the media couldn't go, even though they were public. So a public university with a public protest where the media were invited, but there's certain zones, you're not aware of what they are, but you cross the line and all of a sudden you're violating some kind of sacrosanct law or rule within a campus. Well, ESPN naturally sent a photojournalist to take pictures, not interview anybody, just take pictures. And as he was doing it, you can see the video on YouTube, a woman jumps in front of the camera and starts to harass the guy and tell him he's got to leave, he's like an aggressor or whatever, and at some point she actually asks for muscle. She says, I need some muscle over here to get rid of this guy. Who's going to help me get rid of this guy? That woman teaches communications as part of the journalism school. Incredible amounts of confusion there. I assume she's qualified for that position. I assume she's very bright. I have no reason to doubt otherwise. What you can see, though, is that when preferences matter more than truth, and we sacrifice truth on the altar of our own feelings and autonomy, wisdom is the first casualty. Second casualty, though, is integrity. This is as much for the church as it is for anybody else. Because we're trying to get the post-truth speck out of the culture's eye, but we forget that sometimes we have a little plank, or not so little plank, of post-truth on our own. I remember in 2015, when the Obergefell decision came down from the Supreme Court legalizing same-sex marriage in the United States, my email was going off and parts of my social media feeds were going off with stories of a gay activist who had sued two Christian publishers over their publication of the Bible, trying to get it banned as hate speech, using the Obergefell decision as precedent to get it banned as hate speech. So I thought to myself, that can't be true. That's not true. I'm going to look it up. It took me 3 minutes, friends, a commercial break worth of work, to find out it wasn't true. Yes, a gay man had sued two Christian publishers in federal court over the Bible, but he wasn't seeking to have it banned. He was seeking to have it retranslated because he said that the translation that made it non-gay affirming actually caused him emotional damages. And the lawsuit was filed 7 years before the Obergefell decision, and it was dismissed within 30 days. I happen to know the judge who did it. And it was people who were labeling themselves as Christians who were clicking like or share or whatever it was to circulate the story. Friends, we have to do better. But then you look and you see in the quote-unquote objectivities of the sciences, where the Smithsonian Magazine actually published an article talking about a study that was done. It was a study of studies, where they had taken all these studies of various fields, and they said, these findings were published in like Nature and Science, some of the highest and most prestigious journals in the scientific community. And they said, can we reproduce the findings of all these studies that were published as fact, or at least as conclusive findings in these various issues? They found that they could only reproduce in certain fields 40% of the findings. They could only reproduce those findings in 40% of the cases. In other words, less than half were reliable, yet they were published as fact. Why? Because donning a lab coat does not make you suddenly immune to human biases and human predilections. We are all post-truth people in one sense, and we see it in every aspect. Now, I'm not knocking the sciences, not even a little bit, but I am saying that every single person is susceptible to this because we've vaunted autonomy over clarity. It's resulted in quite a bit of chaos. And the third, and probably the most damaging victim or thing we lose when we sacrifice clarity in the altar of autonomy, is that we lose all sense of accountability and therefore human value. It was Protagoras who said it centuries ago, of course, when he said, man is the measure of all things. There are no gods to dictate above us, or at least no godly authority to dictate from above us what we should or shouldn't do. So we are the ones who determine all things, values, truth, all these things. So human autonomy, human invention is what matters the most. We've been saying this ever since. It wasn't just Protagoras. Listen to the words of Tom Flynn, a secular humanist writer. This is what he says. Secular humanism maintains that through a process of value inquiry informed by scientific and reflective thought, men and women can reach rough agreement concerning values, crafting ethical systems that deliver optimal results across a broad spectrum of circumstances. That's a mouthful of a way to say man is the measure of all things. Through a process of scientific inquiry and reflective thought, men and women can reach rough agreement concerning values. So I ask this question. Despite all of our ingenuity, we have these little machines, these little rectangular computers we call phones for some reason. More computing power in this phone than in the entire computing network that sent the first rocket to the moon. And with this little machine in hand, and all of our ingenuities, and all of our education, have we reached this so-called rough agreement concerning values? Ask anybody on the wrong side of sexism, on the wrong side of racism, on the wrong side of the sharp end of ethnic cleansing or religious bigotry, ask anybody just how rough that agreement actually is. We're not evolving into this wonderful species like a Star Trek-like existence despite our best efforts. There's something wrong going on. At Middlebury College, when Charles Murray, who's no relation, by the way, but Charles Murray, the conservative speaker, was asked to speak there, he had to speak to a room that was with no people in it because the violence threatened for the protest was so great that he had to speak to a camera, and then that was broadcast into another room. And then he and a professor, who I assumed did not share his worldview, were both attacked physically at the university, leaving her with a twisted neck and her hair pulled and all this kind of thing. So I think about this, and think about all the protests that had happened, and the good news is a lot of it's dying down, but some of it still really exists. I ask myself, in light of world events and in light of what's happening on college campuses where free speech was actually championed the most decades ago, I ask myself, where is this rough agreement concerning values? I'll tell you where it is. We've only roughly agreed on the value of being rough. Because there's no accountability anymore. I'm reminded of that poem by Alexander Pope in Essays on Man, When he predicted this as if it was going to come very soon, almost prophetically, he says, "Go wiser thou, and in thy scale of sense, weigh thy opinion against providence. Call imperfection what thou fancy as such. Say, here he gives too little, there too much. Destroy all creatures for thy sport or gust. Yet cry, when man's unhappy, then God's unjust. If man alone engross not heaven's highest care, alone made perfect here, immortal there, snatch from his hand the balance and the rod, rejudge his justice, become the God of God. In pride, in reasoning pride, our error lies. All quit their spheres and rush to the skies. Pride is still aiming at the blessed abodes. Men would be angels, angels would be gods. Aspiring to be gods, angels fell. Aspiring to be angels, men rebel. And who but seeks to invert the laws of nature sins against the eternal cause." He's predicting that we are going to be autonomy-seeking creatures. We're going to turn things upside down, and in the calamity, we're going to think that it's God's fault. And we've taken over the reins. So there is no God. We are him. He predicted that. Do you know why he could predict that? Because he was a student of the Bible. Because Alexander Pope knew his Bible, and he knew that the first post-truth people were Adam and Eve. Because the preferences mattered more than the truth. The truth was they were to walk and talk with God in the garden in the cool of the day. That was what their entire purpose was, to commune and be with God. Their preference was to be with God. I'm sorry, to be God, not to be with God. And so they live with the rule, don't eat of the lot of the tree of good and evil. They live with that rule for who knows how long without being tempted. But then Satan comes along, and he misquotes God. And then Eve misquotes God back, and Adam falls for it as well. And the reason why all this works is because their preference was to be God, not to be with God. And that's when Satan gets them. The post-truth culture today has blossomed and borne its own fruit, but the seeds were planted in that first garden. That's why Pope could look at it and say, this is man's problem. This is man's problem. Secularists know this too. Yuval Harari, in his book Sapiens, a secular atheist Jew, says 70,000 years ago, Homo sapiens was still an insignificant animal minding its own business in a corner of Africa. In the following millennia, it transformed itself into the master of the entire planet and the terror of the ecosystem. Today, it stands on the verge of becoming a god, poised to acquire not only eternal youth, but also divine abilities of creation and destruction. We are more powerful than ever before, but have very little idea what to do with all that power. Worse still, he says, humans seem to be more irresponsible than ever before, self-made gods with only the laws of physics to keep us company. We are accountable to no one. We are consequently wreaking havoc on our fellow animals and on the surrounding ecosystem, seeking a little more than our own comfort and amusement, yet never finding satisfaction. Is there anything more dangerous than dissatisfied and irresponsible gods who don't know what they want? From Pope to Harari to our own experiences, we know this. We know it like we know our own reflection. We're no longer accountable to anyone, and it's coming to a very serious danger where we no longer regard anyone either. We're not accountable to anyone, and so we no longer regard anyone else. That's why the right and the left can say the things they say to each other, because honestly, the push now is to make us into either sophisticated chimps or just meat computers, as I heard one atheist say in a debate. Well, why not devalue a meat computer? Why not try to do away with a sophisticated chimp who's in your way? Evolution tells us that nature is red in tooth and claw, after all. Why not be that way? Why not devalue human life? And that's what we're seeing today. So the first casualty is wisdom, the second casualty is integrity, and the third casualty is accountability and human value. Is there a way out of this mess? Is there a way out? And I think there is. And I'll tell you what, it won't be with these little machines that we keep thinking give us autonomy. You can look and see anything you want to see in the world right now on this little machine that has opened up the world to you. Yeah, what do we do with this? We spread misinformation, we cyberbully, or we objectify human beings and look at pornography and make people into objects for our lust. I want you to think about this for a moment. We name these things now. It's Alexa or Siri or whatever it's called. We give it a name. We've humanized this object that allows us to objectify human beings. Is there a way out? I'm telling you right now, I know the picture I painted for you is very gloomy, but I'm very optimistic, actually. It might surprise you to know this. I'll tell you the reason why I'm optimistic. So when we go to these universities and we do these open forums or do the debates that we do, they come sometimes by the thousands. The Breslin Center at Michigan State University was filled. 9,500 people filled the Breslin Center for an Ask Anything session that Ravi and I did 2 years ago, and the lineup was super long, and it was almost entirely non-Christians who were standing at the microphones asking questions, and they weren't asking zingers. We did this at Yale. We did this at Berkeley. We've done this at University of Florida. We've done it at Penn State. We're going to do it in Miami in February. We've done it all over the place, and what you're seeing over and over again is people, especially the young people, who have engaged in the post-truth bender only to wake up with the grisly hangover of having their preferences fully indulged, and now they want truth. Who is going to give it to them? Let me start to bring this to an end by focusing on the hope. You have to have the hope. So you can point out the flaws. People will begin to see it. And I've seen changes in people when they see the flaws in a post-truth culture or a post-truth mindset. But you have to offer them something to fill the vacuum. And I think that vacuum is the gospel. You see, the culture rejects the Bible as a freedom-giving book, as a freedom-giving message, because it thinks that the Bible is this arbitrary set of rules written by dusty old people who had arbitrary prejudices and used God to justify it. Like, I don't like that behavior. That's icky, therefore God said don't do it. Or we don't like women, so let's oppress women with biblical strictures and all these kind of things. None of it's true, but that's what the culture thinks. That's the narrative of the culture. And so they see all these quote-unquote restrictions as if they are freedom-killing, when the reality is freedom has to have restrictions in order to be truly freedom. It has to have that. Autonomy knows no boundaries, but that leads to chaos. And so the Bible is, correctly, it is a book that stands against human autonomy, because that leads to our downfall. But it is not a book that stands against freedom. It actually is a freedom-expressing, freedom-loving, freedom-giving book. Freedom has to have limitations. When my wife and I were buying our house, this is years ago, my newly minted 15-year-old was barely one year old when we were thinking about buying our house. So we go to the house, and we're looking at it, thinking about buying it, and it has a very large backyard. Like, wow, this is a great backyard for the kids to play in. We only had the one, but we wanted more. And man, it would be great for them to just enjoy this backyard and to be able to run and play and kick the ball and do all that. The problem with it was it backed up to a main road. It's a main road, cars and trucks whizzing by all the time. So we were very nervous. But what we did was we set a boundary. You cannot play beyond here. This is the boundary. Because if you don't have a boundary, the ball will bounce into the street, and kids being who they are, they won't look both ways, and they'll smash into something, or a car will smash into them, and it'll be all over. The boundary allowed the children to enjoy the purpose of the backyard. Freedom requires at least some level of boundary. Otherwise, it becomes chaos and dangerous. Chesterton put it so beautifully when he said that even art has its limitations. The essence of every picture is the frame, after all. You must draw, if you want to find yourself free to draw a giraffe, you must draw him with a long neck. If, in your bold, creative way, you hold yourself free to draw a giraffe with a short neck, you will really find that you are not free to draw a giraffe at all. The moment you step into the world of facts, you step into the world of limitations. You can free things from incidental characteristics, but you ought not to free them from inherent characteristics. You may try to free a tiger from his cage, but you dare not free a tiger from his stripes. If you try to free a camel from his humps, you have found you have freedom from being a camel at all. Facts and truth are the boundary in which freedom truly flourishes, because facts and truth lead to purpose. This is what Jesus has to say about it all. He so beautifully couples it. John chapter 8. It's well known to many of you, John chapter 8, verses 31 to 36. When Jesus is talking to those who believe in him, he says, if you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Very common statement. But do you see what he's done? He said, if you abide in my word, you'll truly be my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. He couples truth and freedom together. The culture links preferences and freedom together. Jesus says, no, truth and freedom are linked together. They're inextricably intertwined. Now, their response to him is ludicrous. It is ludicrous. They answered him, we are offspring of Abraham and have never been enslaved to anyone. How is it you say you will become free? You are offspring of Abraham and have never been enslaved to anyone. Did you forget 400 years of bondage you spent in Egypt? And by the way, you celebrate your liberation from that every single year at the Passover. And by the way, do you know when they're saying this? While under Roman occupation. Isn't it interesting how your preferences can distort the way you see reality? And Jesus lovingly, in his wonderful way of being bold, beautiful, and compassionate, says, truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who practices sin is a slave to sin. The slave does not remain in the house forever. The son remains forever. So if the son sets you free, you'll be free indeed. Did you see it? You know the truth, and the truth will set you free. The son will set you free. The son is the truth. He equated his very being with truth itself. Now, you can't just say that kind of a thing. You got to back that kind of a claim up. They asked him in John chapter 2, what authority do you do these things by? Who do you think you are? And he says, when you destroy this body, this temple, meaning my body, I will raise it up again in 3 days. He gave an objective truth claim. He could have said, when you destroy me, my message will live on forever, like Buddha would have said. Or he could have said, the eloquence of my words is enough to captivate the imagination, like Muhammad would have said. He could have said that he would rise spiritually, like the Jehovah's Witnesses actually say. No, he didn't say any of those things. He said, when this body dies, I will raise it up again. That is either true or it's false, and your opinion is irrelevant. He was able to falsify. He gave a falsifiable claim. Bold. I have defended the historical evidence for the resurrection. It's one of the reasons why I became a Christian in the first place, was because of the amazing evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And I've defended it in numerous debates. You can catch one of them that was live streamed a couple of years ago at Western Michigan University with the atheist John Loftus. I think it's tremendous, the amount of evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And this is what's going on here, is that he has the power to offer us freedom and clarity because he rose from the dead. Here's why, and it comes down to a simple equation for me. People often ask me, why do you trust Jesus to be the source of truth and that he died for your sins and that somehow he was right in all this? Here's my simple answer. Jesus claimed to be the Son of God who died on the cross and rose from the dead to pay for my sins. Now, if he died and stayed dead, I would have no reason to believe him. But if he died and rose again, I'd have every reason to believe him because guys who rise from the dead tend to be credible. But it's the foundation for human value and for spreading hope the gospel has. It really does. The message of the gospel, not just the work that Christians do, although that's fantastic. You know, Mark Twain was famous for saying, history does not repeat, but it sure does rhyme. I don't know if it's him or someone else, but I know it's Mark Twain gets attributed a lot of clever things, and so I'll just go with Mark Twain. But it's interesting because history does not repeat, but it does rhyme. I think he's right about that. It was the Christian movement, the gospel message itself that said we're all equally sinners, but we're all equally offered redemption, that was the birth of all equality. It wasn't a Roman idea. It wasn't a Greek idea. It was a uniquely Christian idea that all of us have equality before God and therefore should have equality before each other. And that's what led Christians to do such good work, even to the pagans who were persecuting them, that the pagan emperor Julian actually wrote to his captains and his generals and his political authorities that it is an embarrassment because the insipid atheists or the Galileans were winning the hearts and minds of the populace because they take care not only of their own, but they also take care of us. And then you fast forward a few hundred years, a few centuries, and you find it's Christians who are rushing onto the plague ships to tend to those who are sick with the plague, getting plagued themselves. And then fast forward a few more hundred years, and you find that it's Christian doctors who rush into Ebola-infested Africa and contract Ebola themselves, trying to help people who don't know Christ but need to know him desperately. History doesn't repeat, but it does rhyme. And the chorus is the gospel. So much so that Matthew Paris, the atheist, who was born in Africa, wrote an article entitled Why Africa Needs Christianity. Listen to what he says. It's a good article. You should all read it. But this is the quote. after having looked and seen what Christianity is doing in Africa, not just the aid efforts and the whole thing with, you know, giving them food or giving them vaccines or whatever, but the message of the gospel was changing Africa. This is what he says. Now a confirmed atheist, I have become convinced of the enormous contribution that Christian evangelism makes in Africa. Christian evangelism, sharply distinct from the work of secular NGOs, government aid efforts, and international aid efforts. These alone will not do. Educating and training alone will not do. In Africa, Christianity changes people's hearts. It brings a spiritual transformation. The rebirth is real. The change is good. It's an atheist saying that the message of the gospel changes people's hearts. That's remarkable. But also offers a very personal hope, a very personal hope. You know, people who come to the open forums and they come and they ask their questions and they're almost always personal. Yes, it's a problem of pain question. How can there be a God with so much pain in the world? Or what does the Bible have to say about my sexuality? Or what about suicide? We get increasingly the number of questions about suicide in public. They're actually talking about it in public at a microphone, about their thoughts about ending their own life or self-harm or whatever it might be. These are intensely existential questions. So the philosophical and the historical have become very real very quickly. And the problem is they're seeing Christians on one side sort of railing against, we're con this or against this or anti that, and we're actually pro-love and pro the message of the gospel is pro-people. But the Bible, it does have its restrictions, and we can't compromise on that. We have to use compassion. But there's this lack of understanding, and therefore a lack of hope. It reminds me of Thomas Bracken's poem, Not Understood. When he says, not understood, we move along asunder. Our paths grow wider as the seasons creep. Along the years, we marvel and we wonder why life is life, and then we fall asleep, not understood. Not understood how many breasts are aching for lack of sympathy, day by day. How many cheerless, lonely hearts are breaking. How many noble spirits pass away, not understood. O God, that men would see a little clearer, or at least judge less harshly when they cannot see. O God, that men would draw a little nearer to one another, they would draw nearer to thee and then be understood. A young man came to the microphone at Yale University, giving a very similar talk to this. And he said, I see how truth leads to freedom, but you've injected this whole Jesus thing into the equation. Help me see how this Jesus thing, how this whole Jesus idea actually leads to freedom as well. I'm missing the dots here. I'm not connecting the dots here. And does the resurrection have anything to do with it? What a question. What a brilliant question. I couldn't wait to answer that one. Essentially, the answer comes down to this. Jesus says that you and I are made in God's image. You're not a sophisticated chimp, a cosmic accident, or a meat computer. You are made in God's image. That is a uniquely biblical Christian thing to say. And that we have fallen away from the purpose for which we were created, which was communion with God, because of our quest for autonomy. But in doing so, we've incurred a debt to God, and only one can pay the debt, he who has no debts of his own to pay. He claimed he could pay it by dying on a cross, and then he rose from the dead to prove he was right. So I believe that you're made in God's image, I said to that young man, because Jesus rose from the dead, and he claimed it in the first place. So do you see what's going on here? Is that you now have freedom. Freedom is not the ability to do whatever you want, whenever you want, whatever way you want. That's not freedom. That's autonomy. That leads to death. Freedom is the ability to do what you want based on what you should, the moral law that comes from God, in accordance with what you are, the very purpose for which you exist. What you want, what you should, what you are, that's freedom. And that's what Christ offers you. For 2,000 years, we've debated this issue about is there only one way to God and all these things, and we've tried to find fulfillment in personal truths and put our eggs in the basket of things that are neither personal nor true. We want career, we want money, we want success, we want movies, we want sex, we want all these experiences, none of which end up being personal. We even depersonalize that which is personal and think it's somehow true, my truth, whatever that means. We don't want truth, we want a personal truth. Jesus says that's not the way. And secular bands, secular artists notice this. There's a song called Crash Parallel, which I'll quote and then I'll be done, called Rain Delays. The secular band points out that this quest for fulfillment and clarity and meaning in stuff and experiences is hollow, and we need to fill our void with someone who's capable of filling that void. And they say sleepless nights and endless days and miniskirts and serving trays, selling sex for pocket change, waking up from rain delays, and living off the alcohol with no one but a cab to call, lost inside a bathroom stall, this carbon copy life withdrawal, and driving cars we can't afford, just making sure we're never bored, between coffee grinds and corner stores, and chasing jeans with fishing nets and limousines and cigarettes and long weekends without regrets. Well, no one here is taking bets. I need someone to believe in, someone to fill this space with grace, someone to look into my eyes and touch my face, someone to make me strong, someone to make me belong, someone to make me alive. It can't be another human being, because that other human being is looking for someone just like that, just like who can fill their own void and their imperfections. It's got to be the perfect one, the one who can fill the space with grace, look into our eyes, touch our face, make us strong, make us belong, make us alive. We're not immoral, we're dead. And we need to be brought alive again. And they recognize it. For 2,000 years, we've been looking for things that are neither true nor personal to fill our void. But I offer you Christ Jesus, in whom the person of Christ made truth available to all of us, because truth was a person. God bless you all. Thank you so much.